Absorption, prologue. Asleep, a man of living crystal lies on a silver bier. Can it be possible to truly sleep with eyelids so clear, so transparent? Yet he does, he and the crystalline woman nearby. Her bier is silver too, inscribed with angular scarlet runes glowing softly in vacuum. Is that a twitch of the man's fingertip? Around them stands a hall of glass and sapphire hung with shields, some of battered leather, while others look unused. All bear runes that glimmer red. The man's face wrinkles, highlights rippling through pliable crystal, and he rocks his head, rolls a little to one side, then sees the woman. Pushing himself up, he swings his legs to sit sideways on the bier. You're so beautiful, and I know you. They are words without sound, for there is no air in here. Oddly, it makes no difference to the way he feels, chest swelling as if inhaling vacuum. Fluids moving inside his complex body, his mind coming alive. The woman's name does not matter for now, and neither does his own. Soon he will know all he needs to know. Scarlet runes are glowing brighter now. Down to the floor, he feels its temperature through crystalline soles. He hears nothing save the internal sounds of his body, and finds it easy to stand, to walk, to look around. There is an archway, and he walks towards it, through it. And he finds a larger hall, star-shaped with 9-pointed annexes. Near the ceiling, a constellation of 19 dots of sapphire light is shining. Each annex leads to a hall with polished biers, the nearest. A place of silver and emerald contains another crystalline man, while above him floats an array of 23 shining lights, all of them green, like burning copper. He remembers burning, and oxygen, and being alive in normal flesh. Then he staggers with this memory. Floating in space, surrounded by a billion blazing suns. Tumbling, he sees what he was meant to see, like a needle thrust by gods through the galactic core, a jet 1,000 light-years in extent, its brightness a soundless resonance in his mind, a scream of fear amid magnificence, because this should not be here. This is the work of darkness. As he rotates, the abomination slides out of sight, and he can remember what he should be feeling, awe and joyous humility, for he is the tiniest fragment of awareness at the galaxy's heart, living for an eye-blink no more, so how important can humanity's welfare be? But then the galactic jet is visible once more, and this time he feels anger, because humans may be insignificant to the cosmic history, but not to ourselves, and the betrayers deserve to die, while we do what we can against the darkness. There is a spear on the wall nearby, and he takes it down to use as a staff. The runes along its shaft flare brightly at his touch. He stands for a while, leaning on the weapon, letting the emotions from his flash of memory diminish. Soon he will deal with things much better. From one annex, a corridor leads away, long and straight, ending in a patch of blackness that draws him. He begins to walk, first with the spear's support, then with a growing feeling of aliveness, shifting his grip. He continues with the weapon held horizontally beside his thigh, feeling secure. In this place there is no danger. He comes out on a rune-carved balcony of stone, and stares at a black, star-strewn sky, above a landscape of grey and sharp black shadows. A chiaroscuro of lunar wilderness, because this is indeed the moon that orbits Earth, the world that gave birth to humanity, but not to him, not directly. Beneath the clouds of that living world, bands of crimson and silver shine more brightly than oceanic blue. What they signify, he does not know. Hello, my love. The words are inside his head. Smiling, he turns to see the crystalline woman. My beautiful Gavi. Is that my name? He reaches out, his clear hand grasping hers. I'm sure it is. If you remember mine, let me know. They stand looking out at the surface for some unknown time. How long have we slept? It's a fair question. He is about to tell her that he does not know, when something causes his gaze to drift to a familiar constellation. Three distinct stars form a row. Sirine's belt. What colour is the central star? It seems red. Does that mean something? If he waits long enough, she'll remember the answer by herself. He tells her anyway. It means a million years have passed. Her fingers squeeze his. So much time. They stare at the banded earth, sharing wonder, not knowing why they are here. Then words sound inside them, delivered by a feminine voice they respond to, a voice of command. You remember what we've always known to do? Observe what the enemy does, deduce what the enemy intends, and then prevent it. It is the awakened woman, Gavi, who responds. And now we fight the darkness. Now we fight. From the lunar night, like the All-Father's eye, the homeworld of humanity regards them as it swirls with cloud, banded with silver and crimson, changed in ways they cannot know. The crystalline man raises his spear, saluting Earth. And then, in soundless vacuum, he laughs. Chapter 1. Fulgor, 2603 AD. Roger rolled straight out of bed to his feet. According to his old school's neurokinesthetics teacher, this was typical acrophobic behaviour, but all he knew was it felt good to be alive, particularly today because this was freedom. It was also scary. Tomorrow, aged 18 standard, he would wake up in a new room, his parents far away. His physical wake-up routine was complex. Moving his limbs through cloverleaf patterns, rolling on the floor, neither dance nor yoga nor fighting, yet with elements of all. It had been a while since anyone had bullied him, but he remembered the humiliation. Slapping a glob of pine-scented smart gel on his chest, he walked around the room, touching each wall in turn, tapping the orange quick-glass bed with his foot, saying farewell. As the gel wriggled across his skin, cleansing and exfoliating, he checked the two-ring on his middle finger. Above it, a tiny real-image hollow ninja sprang into being, holding a scroll that spread out in an old-style four-speak lattice, listing the templates stored inside. His favourite holodramas, his furniture design. If he wanted his new room to look like this one, then it would. And his clothing, all his artifacts besides childhood toys, those he was leaving here. All the information he needed was in his two-ring. He was packed, ready to go. After pulling on a suit of clothing, he tuned the fabric to dark blue, edged with yellow, and hardened the slipper's soles, suitable for outdoor walking. Then he tapped his two-ring and pointed at the quick-glass bed, sub-vocalising a command. The orange quick-glass shivered, grew viscous, and melted into the floor, absorbing the smart fabric duvet. Some people change the living environment daily, but his room's configuration remained static in normal times. Dissolving the bed was a gesture, marking a transition, an adult at last. He went down to breakfast. Mum smiled at him, waving a bowl of peach rice. You need to fuel up. Big day, isn't it? I guess so, aged parents. Dad, are we going to the city together? But his father's eyes were solid white, the smart lenses opaque, lasing images against his retinas. Even over breakfast he was hard at work. Carl, have words with the upstart son, why don't you? Sure. Dad's smart lenses cleared. Plasma, neg entropy, custard. How am I doing? His eyes looked grey now. That was no more the truth than white opacity had been. You're confused, said Roger. I can beat you this morning. Suicide chest, seven dimensions, most negative points in 2 minutes to win. In 2 or 3D, it was a fast game, offering pieces to the opponent to take, the objective being to get rid of your pieces as quickly as possible. Given a vulnerable opposing piece, you had to take it. But if there are several you got to choose, then that was part of the art. Seven dimensions could slow the game right down or cause cataclysmic high-speed reversals, depending on the game flow. Deal. Mum said nothing, as they worked on virtual boards visible only to them, Roger flinging around his yellow pieces with sub-vocalised instructions, failing to hold back the onslaught of red attackers he was bound to take, unable to avoid the tide dissolving before him. When the game popped out of existence, Mum put a bowl of rice in front of Roger. He'll take you into Luca City anyway, never mind. Roger looked at Dad and they both shook their heads. Mum, you're a genius. Part of the game had been to mask their body language. Without access to their shared virtual holo, Mum should have been unable to work out who won, though the odds were against Roger. I tried to keep up with my favourite son, she said. You know I'm your only son. That's right, isn't it? Fair enough. Dad smiled. The banter was familiar. But there's no such thing as a fair fight, Roger and Mum said together. Keep that in mind. Dad smiled with one side of his mouth. In the big bad world. Mum let out a breath. I'll remember. Roger blinked, misting his smart lenses. Phew, is it time we got going? You haven't finished your... I don't think I can. When I get there, I'll eat. Promise. You're not too big to get clipped round the ear. No. Roger smiled at her. And I never will be. Dad's hand clapped his shoulder. Spoken like a man. Goodbye, Mum, said Roger. The air cab ascended in a spiral, the house and its blue surrounding flagstones diminishing below. In the conjoined calderae to the north, giant silver guardian fish leapt from dark waters hunting terror strikes. Overhead stretched a lime green sky with golden cream clouds. They passed over a scree slope leading to the nearest hyperzone. Far from its natural habitat, a purple native slime gel followed a slick track, moving by laminar flow, sheets of tissue looping like caterpillar tracks. Once out of poisonous oxygen, it would split apart to form a fast-moving herd of fist-sized blobbers. "That's a big one," said Roger, "near to budding." He meant generating a suborganism, a daughter herd. "How can you tell?" Dad touched his shoulder. "You belong here, son, in a way I never will." A tight claw of tension squeezed Roger's torso. "Then why don't you let me leave?" Because there were other places he could venture, far beyond Lucas City, beyond the world of Fulgore, even beyond the universe. But this was a hired air cab, and for all of Dad's capabilities, the stakes were too high to discuss confidential matters here. If he'd wanted to raise the subject, he should have done so at home. Well, that was what he thought. But what Dad did next surprised him. "Let's talk openly, but this air cab is, well, special. We're protected here." Beneath them, a valley was filled with striped fog, a moving tiger skin configuration of purple and green, forming a Turing pattern, emergent properties from simple chemistry. "How protected?" "This much." Dad reached up and dabbed at his eyes, removing his smart lenses. "See?" Freed of disguise, his natural eyes were obsidian, without surrounding whites, black upon black, dark as space. "You can't be serious." Roger reached up to his own smart lenses, then stopped. "I can't." "That's a good inhibition to have, son." "While I'm among ordinary humans, you mean?" "Yes, you do belong here, Roger. I meant that." "And Labyrinth, isn't that where I was born?" Dad looked away as if checking the sky. But if they weren't shielded from SatScan, then they wouldn't be speaking like this. "Maybe I've been wrong." Roger tried to work out the right words to say, some persuasive rhetoric that would change Dad's mind all the way. Nothing occurred to him. "You've had to live with secrets your whole life," said Dad. "We even wore smart lenses around you at home when you were a baby." "I know." Meaning, he'd heard the stories before. "I don't remember that, or the time in nursery that you had to mind wipe the teacher." "It was a very selective amnesia," said Dad. "And you only betrayed yourself once." "Betrayed you, you mean?" There was a tightness in Roger's voice that he hadn't intended, a roughness of accusation. "It's important what we do here, but there's something I've forgotten to tell you, son."
"What's that?"
"The most important things in my life are you and your mother." Such simple words. There was a directness in those jet-black eyes that Roger could not withstand. Then he rubbed his face and made himself smile. "What about your other lover?" "Her. She'll take you any place you like, any time. Doesn't it make you want to fly away from Fulgore? Away from everything?" Dad's answer was filled with surprising vulnerability. "You'll never know how much." Neither said anything, as Dad replaced his smart lenses and his normal expression, settled back in the seat and closed his eyes, pretending to work. They alighted on the edge of a piazza, in the shadow of an aqueduct. Dad paid the air cab, the fare a simple four-dimensional money matrix in the 200-dimensional phase space of Fulgidi finance. Occasionally Mum or Dad complained about the complexity of buying or selling, especially if any luculenti were involved, but Roger had never known anything different. The cab ascended into the green sky, looped behind a grandiose quick-glass tower and was gone. This week's architectural fashion favoured trompe-l'œil illusions, and many of the 24 towers in sight looked translucent or oddly shaped, including several that were formed from impossible polygons. Or appeared to be. Skywalks hung among the towers like necklaces, sparkling where the sunlight struck. "You're mediating some kind of deal," Roger said. "Uh-huh. The more sophisticated Fulgidi merchants become, the more resourcefully they find ways to disagree with each other. I never thought of that. So often they fail to negotiate because their plans are just so twisty and complex." There was something different in Dad's tone, as if talking to an equal, or perhaps that was some kind of wishful thinking. "You've got to go straight away." "I'm afraid so. I want to catch some of them before the meeting starts. How long have you got to wait?" "Another 47 minutes. Roger knew the answer automatically. "I thought I might buy myself some Gentrasta, maybe some chocolate." "Chocolate?" some new thing from Earth. Wasn't that the name of an old programming language? Anyway, have a good first day. They hugged. Thanks, Dad. As Dad walked away, he reformatted his clothes so that a pale grey cloak hung from his shoulders. He walked towards a sheer ceramic pillar, support for an aqueduct, then brushed past a steel buttress. Only Roger saw what happened next. Dad's hand disappeared inside the solid-looking steel, came out in a fist, then tucked inside his cloak. Out in the open like this, Satscan would normally notice such a manoeuvre, but an attenuated tingling in his nerves told Roger that Dad had deployed a smart miasma to make subtle optical shifts in light travelling upward. It was called a dead letter drop, and his parents had taught him the basics and the variations years ago, while the technique itself was centuries old, tried and true, was how Dad described it. For even espionage has its traditions. Chapter 2, Earth, 777 AD. Ice covered the upper slopes, reflecting cold orange dawn. Above circled two ravens. On a wide irregular ledge, Ulfr crouched, spear in one hand, his other fist inside Brander's leather collar, tight against the warhound's bunched and trembling muscles. Their prey, so magnificent, so handsome, paused beneath their ledge, perhaps hearing the beating of hunters' hearts, or sensing their breath upon the air. Antlers raised as nostrils flared, chestnut's eyes widening, searching for the source of unease. Ulfr's thumb rubbed the true aim rune that Ira had inscribed upon his spear shaft. The gesture brought back the memory of chanting and the altered perceptions that came with the ritual. Now, the stag seemed to grow huge in his vision, while the landscape faded. Lifeblood beat in the long artery in the neck. Ulfr could see the pulse. Soon it would be time. But a raven cawed overhead, causing the stag to jerk upward and catch sight of Ulfr, the whites of its eyes showing as it jumped back. And there was nothing Ulfr could do but fling everything into the moment. He slammed the spear downward in a throw of power, not finesse. Then he was launching himself, springing from rock to rock, while Brander flowed past him, cutting off the route to the forest. Clenching and unclenching the big buttock muscles, dark hooves arcing, fastened spear bobbing from its side, the stag ran, clattering across stony ground, swishing through gorse and heather, fleeing the hunters Ulfr and Brander sprinting in its wake. The stag kicked out, but Brander dodged. "To me," called Ulfr. Brander loped back, then trotted alongside Ulfr as he dropped the pace. Ahead was a desolate, beautiful stretch of heathland and ice, and the stag might continue for hours yet, perhaps until the day's end. The hunt was about to become a test of endurance, more suited to a youthful warrior than to his hound, and Ulfr would have to make sure that he kept track of Brander's fitness. Many times he'd run with Brander across his shoulders. They immersed themselves in running. Ira sometimes said, the Norns weave fate at varying speeds, and the present slowed into a single elongated moment as the pale sun rose to its midday height. All was movement, breath from the working of torso and arms, warmth in the leg's big muscles, the feeling that he could run forever while Brander kept pace. At some point the spear sucked free of the wound and the blood-streaked stag ran on, faster for a while. Ulfr dipped to retrieve the weapon, slowing for a moment, before resuming the rhythm of the chase, heartbeat and footsteps, in time with the chanting in his head, the mesmeric hunting song he memorized as a child of five, some 12 summers ago. He was smiling, and Brander's teeth were bared, hunters together, doing what they were born to do, bound by love, sharing joy in the toughness of the moment. It was late afternoon when the stag failed to clear a rock, stumbled and went down. It lay on its side, kicking, saliva frothing at the sides of its small mouth, eyes wide as Ulfr leaned over, one fist against his chest as he uttered the words of Thor's blessing, so clear and dark and insightful those eyes, now, that seemed to fill with mist, like the surface of a lake at dawn, while the final breath was hoarse, drawn out, lasting beyond the final kick of limbs. "Thank you," said Ulfr. "You honour us with the treasure of your gift." His knife blade was of bronze and it sliced deep and fast, so that slick hotness bathed his hand, blood steaming in the still cool air as he cut the liver free. He sliced it into 9 pieces, tossed 2 to Brander and bit into one, thanking his prey for the warm life it gave him. Blood trickled down his chin and he wiped it. Afterwards he made a dry heather fire, using flint and iron, wrapping the remaining liver pieces in mud and put them to cook. Returning to the stag's body, he unwound cords from his waist, cured sinews from the bear he slew last summer with Hallstein's help, and bound its legs together. Then he sat with knees drawn up by the fire, one arm hugging Brander close, sharing warmth while the liver cooked, and the carcass of its former owner stared with lifeless eyes. Night was a grey-black cavern, clouds like shrouds obscuring the stars, and the moon's glow was dull. Ulfa passed the village boundary, the dead stag heavy on his shoulders, Brander trotting at his side. Ahead, the long halls were cast into silhouette by orange-lit smoke from the fire pit that lay beyond. There was a thunk of axe head in wood, then another, followed by sarcastic laughter. Ulfa wondered who was winning the competition, who was losing, and how much they had bet. Then a moan resonated through the night and he stopped, the carcass pressing against the back of his neck. He squatted down to shrug the weight off, almost springing into the air with release as he stood once more freed of the burden. Brander snarled. "With me," said Ulfa. Was that a raven's shadow passing overhead through night-time clouds? "Me next," he heard. It sounded like Torfi's voice, followed by, "Good aim." This time there was a definite cry. "You whimper like a girl." That growl could only come from Thorvaldr, bear-like warrior and the village's weaponsmith. "Your manhood's next. I like to aim for small targets." "That's too small even for you," said someone. What in the name of Niflheim was happening? Ulfa circled his shoulders, trying to loosen the bands of pain, and tossed his spear from one hand to the other. Then he strode past the single men's living hall and halted, taking in the firelit drama that was worse than he had feared. Jarl, his friend and Ira's brother, stood bound to the hall's doorpost by leather ropes, his shoulders split apart, jagged, white-grey bones soaked in sopping red, gashes and wounds across his torso and bare thighs, a leather gag in his mouth, the terror of hell in his eyes. An axe sailed end over end through the air and smacked into Jarl's stomach, burying its iron head, splitting his liver. Ulfa thought back to the stag, then pushed the memory aside. "What's going on?" he called. Behind the men he knew, a cloaked man pulled down the brim of his hat and slipped back into shadow. Then a tall warrior with long moustaches and braided hair stepped in front of Ulfa. It took a moment to recognise him, Skari, who had gone a Viking as far as Hibernia, normally emotionless, his expression odd and twisted in the firelight. "Young Jarl," he said, "took himself a lover. Over the mountain," as if that would stop us finding out. "A lover? But not a girl, see? This one pokes men. How disgusting is that?" This made no sense. "Stop now. Too late for that. Too late for shit, dick, here." Another axe, another thunk. A butcher's sound, and a gagged scream from Jarl, eyes wide as he stared at Ulfa, then nothing as he slumped head down. Too late for life. Jarl was suffering, but there was no healer who could deal with such wounds, except perhaps in the old stories, not in the hard reality of the Middle World. "I'm sorry," said Ulfa. He took 2 paces forward as he threw. "So sorry, my friend." The spear cracked through ribs, ripped the heart apart, and pierced the wooden post. Death was immediate. Ulfa thumped his fist against his chest, then raised it, offering the sign of Thor's hammer to the disembodied shade. Soon enough, poor Jarl would begin his journey to Niflheim and the Kingdom of Hell. "I've killed Ira's brother." How could poor Jarl, no matter how far he strayed from warrior ways, deserve this? Even some of the gods, the darker gods, were shapeshifters and gender changers, Orthin as much as Loki, the Allfather and the Trickster, both evil as much as good, ruthless and tricky. Was it any wonder that some men followed those ways instead of the bluff, straightforward lives of ordinary warriors, the children of Thor? The villagers, foremost archer, Ifar, was approaching with bow in hand. He looked at Jarl and Ulfa and nodded. "No one deserves that," he said. "Well done." "But you didn't try to stop them." "What, fight the whole village? Defy the chief's orders?" Everything was awful. Falkvar ordered this. Yes, or so they said. Ifar moved his chin to indicate Thorvaldur and Snorri. They were at a feast with a poet, and someone said what Jarl had been up to. I'd been outside to piss, and when I went back in for another mead... Anyway, they'd already hammered Jarl to the ground. Feasting with a poet? Jarl's the poet, or was? I mean, the other one. Lines of puzzlement deepened on faces all around, Ifar and Snorri, Harvarthr and Ormr, Fermundr and Stein, and Thorvaldr, glancing at each other or down at the ground, puzzling something out. Far off in the distance, disturbing chords of music sounded. Da-da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da. Do you hear that? Ulfin knew as he formed the words that they were pointless. Never mind. He would ask Ira. She would know what the music meant, except she had a slain brother to mourn, riven by axes and killed by his spear. And how could this have happened? We were in Sorsel, said Ifar. Does everyone agree? There were both shakes and nods of the head and many frowns. I guess, Thorvaldur inhaled, expanding his barrel chest and blew out. Maybe we were. So who was this poet, said Ulfar. Poet? I thought there was... Ifar, you said the feast was for a poet, yes. I don't know. Ulfar looked from warrior to warrior, seeing only confusion. Whatever happened, it's fading. Stein rubbed his face. What's going on? Nothing now. Then Stein jumped back, blood fading from his cheeks, raising his hand to point at Jarl's bloody corpse. Gods, what's this? You don't remember? What? No, I had a dream that we killed him, but we couldn't have, because... While the others grew horrified at their own thoughts, Ulfar stepped forward and wrenched his spear free. A dreadful hiss sounded. Could Jarl be alive? But it was gases from the corpse, no more. His shade was already gone. With his knife, Ulfar cut the body down and laid it straight upon the ground. Poor Jarl. So where's Ira got to? Falkvar ordered Ari to watch over her. Thorvar shrugged his huge shoulders. He wanted to keep her safe. Thorvar's gaze kept sliding away from Jarl's corpse, then slowly returning. In the Volfus hut? Yes. Unwiped spear in hand, Brander at his side, Ulfar walked away, let the others deal with the body. How was he going to explain that his weapon had ended her brother's life? Inside himself, he searched for any feeling of blood thrill as he remembered the throwing of the spear, any sign of the same ensorcelment that had infected the others. But all he could find was a deep, desperate sorrow and a need to end Jarl's suffering, nothing more. Surely Ira would accept that. Then he was at the entrance of the hut, once shared by Ira and her teacher, but old Nessa had died last summer, leaving Ira the only Volfa, priestess and seeress, in this or the neighbouring valleys. The man, standing guard, Ari, looked blank-faced, and his eyes were making continuous rapid blinks. Ulfa had a good idea what that meant. Is Ira inside? Yes. Never mind, I'll look anyhow. Inside, the hut smelled of herbs and incense. Runes, both painted and carved, formed lines along the ashwood beams. Of course there was no Ira. Poor Ari was entranced, and there could only be one reason, but Ira was too late to prevent Jarl's death. At my hand. But Chief Falkvar had given the orders. What an angry Falkvar might do to a miscreant warrior chief was unthinkable if she blamed him. Sorry, he brushed past Ari, exiting fast. Relax. Ari had gone for his sword. He'd probably forgotten Ulfar was inside, but stopped, perhaps because it was Ulfar and not Ira running from the hut. Inside the main hall, Falkvar was frozen in his wooden chair, one arm upraised and stiff, while Ira, her copper hair incandescent in the torchlight, stood with tightened fists, tears shining on her suffering face. In a rage, she could make Falkvar forget his name, or experience paralysis in arm or leg. Once old Nessa had caused Falkvar's predecessor to go blind for 9 days, as punishment for letting a young cattle thief go free. The chief had not known the thief was a rapist too. All of the tribe's women were fierce, but the Volvas, serious priestesses, were something more. Don't do it, said Ulfar. Jarl is dead. I know. By Freyr! She stared at his spear's bloodied point. You! He was suffering when I found him. Truth? Yes. She turned back to Falkvar, slipping her fingertips down his eyelids, then touched the back of his upraised wrist. As your spirit lowers your hand, good Falkvar, you slip deeper and deeper into normal sleep. And when you awaken later, you'll remember all the visiting poets said and did and be able to tell me free of any ensorcelling effects he left behind as you sink deeper now. Folkvar's hand touched his thigh and his chin lowered, his breathing grew easy, and the softest of snores arose. "He was ensorcelled, he said," she said, "but you are not." "I'm sorry, Ulfa." "But Jarl's pain was, you told the truth, let me do the same." "So you see me as your brother's killer?" "I'm sorry." There was more to it than that, or she would have struck him down with whatever punishment she'd had in mind for Folkvar, but however much she knew that he had granted Jarl a kind of mercy, she also saw the killing thrust inside her mind and could not forgive him for it. At least, that was how he understood her words. When he came to, he hadn't realised he was drifting into sleep. He and Folkvar were still in the hall, and Branda was sitting on the rushes beside him, but Ira was gone. Stiga wept for the beautiful boy he had killed. Seated on a hard rock, staff in hand, he sobbed while his ravens circled in the darkness above, if only they would leave him alone. But he knew by the burning of his left eye, the eye that was missing that did not exist, that however the darkness chose to manifest, however far it sometimes seemed to drift away, it was bound to him and he to it for ever. Sweet Jarl, with lips so soft. On a mouth that was cold and hardened now, soon to be food for worms unless the villagers chose an honourable burning. As he stood, though it was already night, shadows seemed to curl around him, swirling and embracing. Pulling his hat low, gathering his cape, he took a step forward, then another and another, moving as if in dream, call it nightmare, and when his mind cleared, he was at the top of a moonlit slope, looking down upon a village. This would be several days removed by normal walking from the place where Jarl had lived beneath Chief Folkvar's rule. One less poet in the world could never be a good thing, but the shadows had spoken, and Stiga could only hear and do what they commanded. It had been so long since things were otherwise. Another village. Perhaps I can stay longer this time. Sometimes there were periods of ease, of silence from the voices. He was due another sojourn, a time to recuperate. Here, someone had posted nighttime sentinels. He could sense the hiding places, and even with his protection, descending to the village would be a risk. In the morning, he would make himself known and take advantage once more. He forced that thought behind him, then sank down to the ground, curled up inside his rough cloak, and pulled down his hat to cover his face, denying the sight of the ravens that circled still high above in the night.